Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Australian and New Zealand Studies channel on the New Books Network. I would like to pay my respects to the First Nations elders past, present and future. And today we have a guest, Rowena Lennox. And Rowena has written a book called Dingo Bold, The Life and Death of Gari Dingoes. Rowena is in the office, as it turns out, with me this afternoon, and I'd like to introduce her to the show.
Hi, Bede. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
That's fine. Rowena, your background is in book editing for about more than 20 years, and you have a PhD in creative writing from the University of Technology in Sydney, and now do some mentoring as well in creative writing for writers, and you have had this book published by the Sydney University Press. Could you give the audience some background into your professional life and how you came to write this book?
Yes, sure. I studied arts as an undergraduate and majored in English literature. And I always wanted to write. And when I finished uni, I went and worked in publishing companies. So I worked in-house for an educational book publisher and an academic book publisher and a trade book publisher. And I went freelance in the late 90s so that I could work on my first book. So I had the time to juggle to work on my first book, which was a biography of an East Timorese priest. And I kept on freelancing. I was involved in editorial training and I taught editing to university students as well as ghostwriting Kirsty Sword Gusmao's memoir with her, and you know, just kept on doing freelance editing, and it took another 20 years for me to write my next book, which is this one, Dingo Bold. I started a PhD in creative writing in 2014, where I was able to, you know, research this book and write it as part of the university, which was really helpful because the structure was really stimulating, the program, and my supervisors were, it was just great to be able to do it with such wonderful supervision as well.
Mm. Now, how would you like this book described? A few things I've noted about it when reading it are, firstly, it has epigraphs which often have songs or references from sort of more modern pop culture. It deals with historic events. It has a personal trail running through it, and it also has, I suppose you would say, very, very lively parts of the narrative where it almost becomes almost poetic, very, very moving in the words, and other parts are very scientific and very descriptive, and you also introduce people and even have dialogue and conversations with people you come across. How would you describe the book?
Yeah, I describe it as nonfiction, the blanket term, and it does cross genres. When I was writing it, I had a working title for it, Dingoes and People, an Emotional History, and then as I was working more on it, I changed it to Dingoes and People, a Personal, Partial, Eclectic and Emotional History. So I thought of what I was writing as personal essays, I guess, and I wanted to be there as the narrator because I thought that was the most honest way to tell the story. And I put the science in because I think it needs to be in there because it's had an immense impact on the way we regard dingoes, you know, the way we think about them and the science that has come out about them. The history I put in because I think it needs to be there as well because dingoes are historical. I mean, I would call them historical agents. Not everybody would probably go so far as to say that, but they've played such an important role in contact history between Indigenous and settler Australians. They really are, and I'm still working out this idea more, but how they're kind of cultural mediators in a way. Yes, the songs and extracts that I use in the epigraphs were just they were kind of oblique ways at coming at things when I couldn't fit the whole idea into prose. Of course, I was obsessed by dingoes while I was writing the book, and my obsession is under control now, but I'm still flaring up intermittently. So everything fed into the dingo furnace, really. Songs you'd hear and you'd go, yes, that explains how I felt, where you know, I hadn't found the words myself to say how I felt when the dingo approached me on the beach, or, you know, other people's wisdom, I suppose. Like, one of the epigraphs comes from Barbara Chikatu, who was one of the Aboriginal trackers who tracked dingoes after Azaria Chamberlain disappeared at Uluru in 1980. And, you know, it's a very simple statement, but it compresses a lot of knowledge into just a few words. Some of them come from Kafka, who wrote an amazing, it's a story called Investigations of a Dog, which I think speaks a lot about domestication. I think that's the theme of that. It's longish short story. So, yeah, there were just snippets that I found all around me, you know, poems and little bits of dialogue from novels and ways people had of putting things that really seemed to speak to what I was trying to express in the chapter.
Yeah, okay. And to begin discussing the book, two points I would like you to clarify. The first is, with Gari, also known as Fraser Island, is the name Gari now, is it going to be taken over, become the actual proper name of this place in the same way it would now be unusual for people in Australia, well, I hope it is, to refer to Uluru as Ayers Rock, or is it something else?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I believe it might become the name for the island. I mean, the Batchelor were granted native title to the island several years ago, and they call it Gari. So it's still referred to as Fraser Island. Like, I think it's still, people understand what you mean when you say Fraser Island, but increasingly it is being referred to as Gari, and I guess it's just a matter of time. I'd have to put my ear to the ground more on the island and, you know, with the Queensland authorities, I guess, that make these decisions. But I think that's probably the way it's going to go.
Mm. And it's a big place, isn't it? It's actually huge, Fraser Island.
Yes, yeah. It's about 125 kilometres long, I think, and about 25 kilometres wide. It's a long, narrow island. It lies very close to the coast, where at its closest point, at its southern tip, and then it sort of juts out to the north, you know, a long peninsula to the north. Yeah, I think it's about 180,000 hectares, 160 or 180,000 hectares, yeah.
And one other thing about the island, the geography of it, could you say a few words about that? Because in my mind, I always thought of Fraser Island as being a place where it's sandy and you can bring a four-wheel drive. But from the book, it's actually a lot more complicated. It has a lot more complicated vegetation and mountains, and even, I think you might refer to even some lakes and things like that on the interior of the island.
Yeah, it's an incredible place. It's, as you said, it's made out of sand. So it's completely sand. But on this sand grow rainforests and the lakes. It's got these beautiful freshwater lakes. There are different kinds of lakes. So perched lakes and other sorts of lakes, but amazing freshwater lakes all over the island, streams. There's plenty of water on the island, so it's quite unusual for an Australian environment, I guess. You know, the water is so clear in these streams that you can't even see it. You look straight across to the sandy bottom. Yeah. And they run to the sea. And so it's been a source of timber for non-Indigenous Australians started taking timber off in the 1800s. Cattle were grazed there and horses were grazed there. And sand was mined there in the 20th century as well. It's a unique place, a really very hard to get around, very hard to walk on the sand. I visited there a long time ago and thought, oh, we'll put on our backpacks and go hiking, but you can't get very far or very fast on sand. So and you really do need those four-wheel drives. The tracks are sandy and quite eroded, and some of them are quite soft. The beach is better to drive on, but then if the tides come up, you can't pass. You know, there's certain points that stick out, rocky little points that stick out into the water that you can't pass if the tides come in. So, you're really constrained by the natural environment there, and of course, expanded by the natural environment too, I guess.
The next question, this isn't meant to be a philosophical question, but it might sound like that. The question is, what is a dingo?
How long have you got? Well, a dingo is a canid, so a member of the family of canids that includes dogs and includes wolves. And it's an canid that's been living in Australia for thousands of years in isolation from other canids. And they think until, settlers arrived in 1788 and Banks came with Cook in 1770, and apparently he had greyhounds. So, or whether any of the ships that hit the west coast of Australia had dogs on them, and those dogs escaped and lived with dingoes. But dingoes have lived in Australia for thousands of years. No one's sure exactly how long, and nobody's sure exactly how they got here. They didn't evolve here. Like, they're not like kangaroos and the other animals that evolved here. So there's various theories about how they arrived in Australia. Some people assert that they came with people in watercraft, and they may have been brought as food for the voyage, and then when they got here they kind of went and expanded and inhabited the whole continent of Australia. Other people think they may have crossed a land bridge when Australia was part of the Sahul continent, before the last ice age or when the water level was lower. So what they are now, and all these ideas about how they got here also affect what people think they are, because some people think they are a domestic animal that has gone wild or gone feral, and some people think that they have never been domesticated. We know that they lived very closely with Aboriginal people. So when 19th century, 18th century observers came, dingoes were living in camps with Aboriginal people and were regarded as part of the family, were treated like kin. But the relationships with Aboriginal people were quite various across the continent of Australia. So, in some people ate them, some people didn't eat them. It was, not uniform at all. Like First Nations societies aren't uniform. So what are they? They are a, there's theories now that they're the apex predator or the top of the food chain in Australia. Which it's a very hierarchical way of putting things, but they, on land, crocodiles would be the top of the food chain in their environment, and then dingoes would be the top of the food chain. So they have quite a lot of effects on other what they call meso-predators, like foxes and cats. They think that dingoes affect how foxes and cats behave. They only breed once a year, which makes them different from domestic dogs, because domestic dogs can breed twice a year. So dingoes only breed once a year in winter, usually. They eat a lot of meat, but they eat anything. I mean, they'll on gari, they'll fish, they'll eat oranges, they'll eat, you know, like they'll
the whale. You talk about the
yes,
whale.
Yes, yeah. They're sort of opportunistic scavengers, I guess. And of course, on gari, they eat people's food as well. So they'll eat M&Ms or roast meat, whatever they can find. They live in groups. They have a society. So they live in family groups usually, where one pair breed and the other members of the group cooperate to help raise the young. And they usually live in defined territories that they defend. So there's a few things we know about what they are. It's still not decided. Like there's been discussion about what the scientific name for the dingo is, you know, is it Canis familiaris dingo, which would imply that it's like a dog, familiaris, you know, a domestic canid that's gone wild or gone feral? Is it Canis lupus dingo, so lupus from the wolf, you know, that it's not a domestic animal, or another school of thought wants to call it Canis dingo, which, you know, sort of avoids those decisions about the domestic dog or the wolf, and some take some of the value judgments out of it, I guess, as well.
And so does that mean a dingo differs from a dog breed? It's not the difference between a dachshund and a whippet. It's something else entirely?
Yes, I think it does. Even though there's so much variety among dog breeds, I think it's one of the, you know, like you can have a Chihuahua, you can have a St. Bernard, you can have a dachshund, you can, you know, you can have an Old English. Yeah, the dogs are so wildly various. But a dingo does differ because a dingo has to survive in the wild. So they've evolved to be able to survive in the wild, to not need a lot of water. Their chests are often quite narrow and their heads are quite broad, so that the widest part of them is their head. Where the people who do these sort of studies find the most differences is in their cranial morphology, so the shape of their heads and the length of their snout and the size of their teeth, and just that they've got these broad heads. I think that's where it's very hard to tell a dingo from some forms of domestic dog. Like dingoes have a great variety of coat colours, you know, they can be that golden colour that you think of. They also, a good percentage of them are black and tan. That's not an unusual dingo coloration. And some of them are white. There were white dingoes on gari. No black and tan dingoes on gari. But, I mean, I've heard percentages like 30% are black and tan and, you know, maybe a smaller 3 or 5% are white. You know, they're doing a lot of work on dingo genetics, but they can also be brindle. Like a lot of colorations that people once thought were wild dogs, so that, you know, more domestic dogs, you know, brindle, that sort of coat color where it's got a, you know, flecks of black or white through it kind of stripes. You know, you can have brindle dingoes, or, you know, dingoes with a lot of dingo makeup, you know, a lot of dingo genetic, you know, their proportion of dingo genes in them is very high, and, you know, they can be brindle. So it is quite a vexed question, is separating a dingo from a domestic dog. But, yeah, dingoes are different. I mean, they howl, but they can also bark, and they snuff bark, and they make various vocalizations. They do bark sometimes. It's not that they never bark.
Mm. And this isn't in your book as an epigraph, but you've got a quote nonetheless from Duke Ellington, where he refers to he refers to the highest form of genius as being beyond category. And I thought that was quite apt, because it's almost as though they are like these improvising dogs of some sort, and so the jazz connection seemed quite relevant.
Oh, I'm so glad you noticed that. I'm so glad you liked that. Yeah, I agree. Like, why can't they be beyond category? I mean, I guess we need to categorize things, but they part of their troubled relationships with humans, I think, is because they do seem to defy categories. You know, they won't just do what humans think they should do, and that they are, you know, the highest form of genius, as Duke Ellington thought, was being beyond category. I think it really applies to them. You know, because they can be pets, and clearly they've some of them like people, you know, they've had relationships with Aboriginal people for over 1,000 years, probably longer, but just because of the archaeological evidence, you know, I've read sort of science, you know, articles, refereed articles that put it, you know, have found dingoes living in places with humans, dingoes that needed feeding. So there was clearly a domestic relationship. Dingoes, that are 1,000 years old, dingo, you know, on the south coast of New South Wales, buried with people. And they can live wild and they can live in states in between. I think our words are a bit inadequate to describe, you know, tame or wild or camp dingo, or, you know, domestic isn't probably the same thing as what we'd think of with a dog that we'd have as a domestic pet, because I think dingoes would claim their right to wander and their right to hunt, even if they did decide to live with a person.
Yeah. Now, any book about dingoes, I guess, since the 1980s has to start where your book starts, Azaria Chamberlain. It seems to draw so much of Australia into it. It has a child dying, unfortunately, a dingo, which is, as we've just said, a mysterious animal at what is an overpowering place, Uluru, and then a media circus, injustice, just the local Indigenous people seem to have been ignored in their views once the child was missing about what to do and what may or may not have happened. I think you talk about some people whose views were not even really taken seriously by the police and things like that. Could you explain why that was the place to start this book?
Yes. Well, I didn't write that part first. I wrote it later, but it was, of course, it had to be written. It had to be talked about. And also because even now people are still undecided or have decided various things. When I was researching dingoes, a lot of the dingo experts said, yes, this is, yeah, this is what happened. You know, the dingo's capable of this, a dingo would do this. But still people I talk to, like family and friends, would say, oh, no, she did it, you know, or people who very knew a lot about the legal system would say, but there wasn't enough blood. And it was as though people were baying for blood, you know, when Lindy Chamberlain, Azaria's mother, Azaria was the baby who went missing from Uluru, and Lindy was her mother who was jailed for her murder. So it really divided Australia. Everybody had an opinion. I guess I grew up with it as well. And, you know, we made dingo jokes and we, which I guess is a way of you trying to bring a situation that you don't know anything about into control a bit sometimes when you make jokes about things. And I think what happened is so horrible to think about as well, that a baby could have been taken by a dingo in that way. It's unbearable to think about. So maybe people were trying to think about other alternatives for what happened. And, of course, there were terrible miscarriages of justice. So it hasn't gone away. I don't think the Azaria Chamberlain story's gone away, because people still think Lindy did it, even though the most, you know, the inquest in 2012, the Northern Territory coroner, you know, did say emphatically, you know, the cause of Azaria's death was that she was taken and, you know, taken by a dingo. And the dingo ambivalence is still with us too, I think, that there's this animal that we want to think is familiar. They look like dogs sometimes, and we want to think we understand them, and, you know, that they wouldn't do that or they would do that or however, you know, we think they live. But we still have a lot to learn as well, just as back in, you know, 1980 when the dingo experts were called in and they thought that it was possible but improbable or something that a dingo would have taken a baby, even though, you know, it was perfectly clear everybody at the campground, the people who ran the campground, the rangers there, were saying, you know, that there's the dingoes, there'd been several or lots of dingo attacks and lots of near misses.
If we then shift couple of thousand kilometres to Fraser Island, or I'll keep on to put the, say the K first. I've got to actually now look at the word Gari. And you talk, what the book talks about your journeys to Fraser, to Gari. One of the interesting aspects of that, and a lot of the book builds around this, is this code system that the Queensland Wildlife Service has for dingoes. I think it's from A to E or something or other about the dangerousness of each particular dingo or the dingo pack. Could you talk about the way in which dingoes are managed on the island?
Yes. So on the only other time that's recorded in settler history that now, there's been a fatality from a dingo happened in 2001 when a child was mauled by dingoes and bled to death. So so after that time, this incident reporting system was put into place. And as you say, it was the A to E. So people were encouraged to report negative incidents to a park ranger, and then a park ranger would create an incident or interaction report, and any incident that was reported would be coded from A to E. So A was really like nothing happened at all, and B is very inconsequential, I guess. C is like when a dingo loiters around somewhere where people are. So D is more serious, so might involve ripping tents to get food. And then an E is a nip, I guess a dingo makes contact. I mean, it's very hard to code incidents, I think. And I guess they do revisit them. When I interviewed one of the rangers, Linda Berendorf, she said, you know, they'd had advice about how to sort of separate a code D from a code E when, you know, because you're trying to judge what a dingo's intentions are when they go to do something. So does the dingo intend to nip, or does it not intend to nip? And that, you know, changes where it's coded in this sort of scale of severity of the incidents. The language of the incidents reporting is, I think, needs a rethink. So dingoes are reported for loitering, or soliciting food. So if somebody's eating prawns on the beach and a dingo's standing nearby, that they could get an incident interaction report for soliciting. If they take items from a campsite, they're stealing. Which I think is probably not the right sort of language to talk about a free-ranging animal like that. They're very human words, you know, they seem to come from a criminal justice system, even an outmoded criminal justice system. And they're very, it's all about the dingo behaviour. So a human can give a dingo a steak and the dingo gets an incident report. They have started fining people for feeding dingoes, and I read reports that they're really trying to, you know, discourage people from feeding dingoes, because that means the dingoes, of course, are going to go and look for food from people. So, you know, that's a good thing, that I think that the humans are starting to see their role in these interactions between dingoes and humans, but the dingoes are still expected to sort of conform to these human ideas about how they should behave, and the interaction reports are very much part of that system, you know, making a dingo behave. And once a dingo gets a lot of interaction reports, it's regarded as a problem dingo. So, of course, it gets more attention then. The dingo that I wrote about, he was collared because he'd become a problem dingo. So they put a collar with a satellite navigation instrument on it, and, you know, to ostensibly sort of follow him where he went, so that people, you know, so that the rangers knew where he was and if he was creating trouble. But it stigmatises him as well, and, you know, people immediately see the collared dingo and think he is trouble. Yeah, the rangers liked this system. They wanted, because it's better than, you know, it's more data. It's more uniformly organised data. So they could rank the interactions and go, well, this dingo's only had C-level interactions. You know, this dingo's not a problem. This dingo's had E-level interactions. I mean, often it's hard to identify which dingoes are doing doing things because they have ear tags, but the ear tags are hard to see. I mean, when Bold, who I nicknamed this dingo Bold, he approached me, I mean, I knew he had a coloured tag in his ear, but I couldn't have said what colours they were. You know, like my adrenaline was all going. I didn't really, I couldn't, it just was a pattern. It wasn't anything I could have described later. But so that, you know, people are meant to identify dingoes by their ear tags. Not all dingoes are ear tagged, only the ones that are, they think, are likely to interact with people. They would prefer them not to be tagged and not to be visible and not to be anywhere near people. But this pack that live at Yurong have lived at Yurong for generations, and it's part of their territory. And Yurong just happens to be also a major sort of tourist centre and the, you know, a place where people live. So the dingoes have sort of learnt to live with people and learnt to try and use that to their advantage as well, yes. I guess.
The book is, in a sense, a lot of your journeying around Fraser Island, looking at the dingoes, talking about them, meeting people on the island, some of the interactions between them. And could you talk about, just give us some background into that whole middle section of the book, how that came about and what, as the author of the book, you were trying to convey to the reader?
Yes, yeah. So when I started, I thought, well, I'm not an expert in dingoes. I'm going to have to talk to people who know more than I do. I started the book because I loved my dog, and she was a Kelpie cattle dog, and then I expanded it to write an essay about dingoes for an essay competition that wanted to – yeah, that's her, Zephyr, yeah. So I knew I had to talk to people, and I thought Gari was just going to be one chapter of what I was doing. I thought, you know, I'd try and do a continent-wide approach, but Gari was just so interesting. And when my first trip there was to attend a forum where people were talking about, they had a few farmers talking about dingoes and they had a few conservationists talking about dingoes. And it was really interesting to see all these people in the room and see their different ideas about dingoes. And during that visit, I interviewed Jennifer Parkhurst, who is controversial because she was fined for feeding dingoes. She'd been observing them on the island for about 7 years and fed some, and she was prosecuted for that. So I interviewed her, and we went to the island together. She offered to go to the island with me, and she doesn't get to the island very much. And during that visit, I was approached by this young dingo who I nicknamed Bold. And then I read 3 months later that QPWS had, the Queensland government did a press release that, you know, a dingo had been killed, and I, you know, scrambled around to try and find out whether it could have been Bold who was killed. And, you know, it took about a week, but we worked it out that it was Bold who had been killed. So there were a lot of interaction reports about him because he was a dingo that really didn't understand that people didn't want him to approach. He approached lots of people, and the books really draws a lot on those interaction reports because it was, for me, it was a way of finding out what had happened over the last 3 months of his life. I met him when he was about 10 months old, and I mean, he was big, but he was clearly young at that stage. And so, you know, how did things progress from there to result in his death? And 6 months after I interviewed Jennifer Parkhurst, I returned to the region and interviewed some Queensland Parks and Wildlife Service rangers, which was really valuable because I really wanted to have a sort of rounded view on the dingoes and the dingo management policies, because it can be quite adversarial. Dingo management can be quite adversarial across Australia and particularly on Gari. You know, Queensland Parks and Wildlife Service come in for a lot of criticism, and, you know, people were still very raw, I guess, about all the issues around the prosecution of Jennifer Parkhurst and of course around the death of Clinton Gage, the the boy who was killed in 2001. He was only about 9 or 10 years old. So it was a terrible tragedy. And so the Rangers, you know, like, to try and see it from their angle, I guess. I mean, I was very sad that Bold had been killed. Although after I met him, I did think it would be very hard to manage the island, you know, to try and keep dingoes separate from people on the island. And my daughter was 7 years old at that stage, and I just thought, I don't know how I'd come here with my daughter and walk on the beach, because my heart was thumping when Bold came on. I know she wouldn't enjoy that experience very much. The people I interviewed were great. I interviewed an Aboriginal elder who wanted to have a close relationships with dingoes. I interviewed two of the rangers from Yurong who had great knowledge about Bold and his family, and then another who had a great sort of, I guess, not historical knowledge, but, you know, from the early 2000s, who'd been involved with dingoes from the 2000s. So they had great hands-on knowledge. I interviewed a bachelor ranger, which gave another angle on it from the Aboriginal elder who I'd interviewed, because they had slightly different views on it, and which of course is going to be the case. Not everybody's going to be united, even in the bachelor community. So I kind of wanted to get, I guess, many voices into the book, because it's a complex situation, and there's no simple solution, I don't think. I mean, I don't know if solution's even the right word, or, you know, no simple way to coexist.
On that, the point of coexisting, I wanted to ask, the dingo itself, I think of it as an Australian native animal in some way, but it's not the same. You don't see pictures of dingoes in the same way you see pictures of kangaroos or koalas or even Tasmanian devils. Do you think that the dingo in the pantheon of Australian animals is itself sort of ostracized?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really good point. It doesn't have the same role, does it? It's not a herbivore, it's a carnivore. I mean, the Tasmanian devils are carnivores, I guess, but they're not on the mainland, and some scientists think the dingo may have been responsible for the extinction of the Tasmanian devil on the mainland, and also the thylacine. So, you know, it's another black mark for the dingo, I guess. I mean, there's different views about it. You know, they think, you know, the say climate change, or, you know, human populations might have contributed. Yes, but it's, yeah, the dingo is controversial. They are, as you say, they're a native animal. You know, we think of them as an Australian animal, but whether it's because they're a predator and that's a different thing from, even though we've got dangerous animals like snakes and spiders, you know, the dingo is more of a challenge for humans, you know. It's a competitor, I guess, because dingoes prey on sheep. So when humans introduce sheep and cows, you know, they prey on calves as well, not so much, I don't think, full-grown cattle. But you know, so it's competing for resources with us. I think in my research, the dingo's affinity with Aboriginal people definitely affected settler views of it, that the dingo was an ally of Aboriginal people and kin, and that definitely made white observers feel threatened, and you know, you can sort of see the anger burning from the page, and dingoes suffered because of it. I mean, dingoes were killed because of it. The first printed use of the word dingo, which they think comes from the word for tame, was Watkin Tench, who was a Marine with the First Fleet, and he recorded an incident in which Governor Phillips' gamekeeper shot a dingo, because the Aboriginal people had dingoes, and they let them, you know, harass the white people, and then this gamekeeper got cross and shot the dingo, and he a couple of years later, he was speared by Pemulwuy and didn't recover from that. I mean, he did a lot of other bad things, this gamekeeper, but one of them was killing this dingo.
Yeah, well, if I was going to kill someone's dingo, it wouldn't be Pemulwuy's.
Yeah.
In the book itself, you then, there's this section in the book I wanted to ask you as a sort of writer almost, is you have the section where you meet Bold, and the book turns from text to just having these shot after shot, like you're looking at frames from a motion picture film almost, and you really get the sense of this dog coming up to you, and it's almost scary when you're reading it. This nervousness of this interaction with this dog that has this perfect kink in its tail that just looks so dog-like. Could you explain how you came to portray this part of the story in that way?
Yes. Well, I was about we'd seen these two brothers running down the beach, Bold and his brother. I was in a four-wheel drive with Parkhurst. Parkhurst was driving and, you know, looking through, I mean, not while she was driving, but looking through the lens of her camera to, you know, at these dingoes, you know, and we'd seen him follow a man on the beach and stand by the door of the man's vehicle. And then we were driving at a distance from them and just watching what they were doing. And then they disappeared up a track, and Parkhurst stopped the car and rolled a cigarette, and I got out and I was just photographing the footprints, the paw prints on the sand. And then Bold came up to me, and Parkhurst had her camera there. So she took these photographs and, let me use them in the book, which was amazing because I didn't remember the incident in the same way as the photographs depict it. You know, there's parts of the incident that I remember, but the photos, you know, I guess, you know, they don't lie. They, you know, say second by second what happened. I mean, it was a less than 1 minute incident, and I mean, there's a couple of photos that I didn't put in, but they show how he came up to me and how he walked around me and how he came back and looked at me, and then, you know, they show aspects of his posture that I didn't really notice at the time, which I think is really interesting because he was very mercurial, and I guess all dingoes are. Later I saw footage of him. He was a bit older by that stage, but he was, I think some Queensland Parks surf personnel were filming him, and again, he was just he changed, you know, like he was just like Quicksilver, the way he moved and vocalized and mouthed. So to have those pictures was really precious because it gave me the chance to look back on the incident. I mean, I remembered, you know, like I wrote down that, you know, that day what I remembered of the incident, and then to go through the photographs and go, okay, well, this is what happened. And I guess I didn't move. I was very still. And he just walked away of his own accord. So it wasn't at all it was a very benign incident. He was curious, you know. But, you know, Parkhurst said afterwards, oh, I didn't know whether he was going to mouth your leg at that stage at one point, you know, and people say don't turn your back on a dingo sort of thing. I was trying to be nonchalant, like just look at the sky, you know, because I'd seen the man, he followed the man, and the man had just ignored him and just kept on doing what he was doing. But I was really nervous, but I sort of saw him flinch and I thought, oh, he's really nervous too. I think I could scare him away if I had to, you know, if I had to sort of be gruff and make a cross sort of noise at him. But maybe, you know, maybe I'd misread him, you know. I mean, he did end up nipping a couple of people. He never broke their skin. The first person he nipped actually ran from him, so which is don't run. I mean, it wouldn't be recommended to run from a dog either, but, you know, don't run from a dingo because that sort of activates their prey drive, their chase sort of drive. The second person he nipped, it just seemed to come out of the blue again, and that's what precipitated him being killed, that second nip.
Now, we'll have to finish up relatively soon, but there's a few more things I wanted to ask. I want to draw your attention to two parts of the book, parts I underlined, just the way in which you've used words, and I want to ask you why you express things like this. One is after Bold has died, and you say in mid-October, around the second new moon since Bold was killed, and then the sentence goes on. Just that expression, dating it by the second new moon. Was that, what was your thinking there?
Well, I think the dingoes would be very aware of the moon, the size of the moon and the light that was coming out from it. And a lot of things happened around the new moon. When I started to look into it, like I was interested in the tides and where the tide was at, where the moon was at, the light, how that affected things. And I started to count as well, like after Bold was killed, say in August and then September and then October, like I was counting the, you know, how many moons has it been since Bold was killed. So there I was in Sydney and, you know, on the island, you know, all that distance away, things were taking place. So I guess the moon unifies people because, you know, we're all under the same moon, really.
Yeah, that was good. I like that. The next one is a sentence where it begins with the words, I followed the shorts and long white socks of our impossibly young pilot across the tarmac to board. You're going onto a plane here. But what I want to ask about that was, this might just be me reading too much into your work, but it's almost as though, and the book has this in you, it's almost like the author, you've taken the dog's point of view. The dog would follow the person's socks. It's like what you're doing, but also how dogs have white socks is such a dog type thing to even have. Dogs have white socks.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's brilliant. I really like that. I didn't think I was taking the dog's point of view, but yes, I find with descriptions of people, it can be very cliched very easily to describe a person, but I did notice the socks, you know, the socks of the pilot, and I didn't want to look too long at his face, and I don't know whether that's I'll be thinking about this afterwards, you know, whether that's canid like behavior or not, but I you know, you can look at someone's shoes and you won't cause offense either, you know. Mm. You can to sort of look someone in the eye and go, oh my goodness, you look about 12 and you're flying that plane over. I mean, you know, that they might be able to read your thoughts if you do that. So I kept my focus on the ground, but to say it's like a dog, that, yeah, I like that.
Well, there's some young pilot around Australia who's immortalised in a book about dingoes, so he'll be happy, I hope, or she was. I'm not sure who it was.
It was a male pilot, yeah.
And the final question I'd like you to comment on is, you refer to a writer called Ugo Mattei, and I've probably said his name incorrectly, but he's a sort of a philosopher of some sort, and he makes this point, which the book to me is one of the main themes in the book, is that the dingo is perceived as a problem, and mostly the problem has come about because we interact with the animal. We feed it. We encourage it in some way because we look at it. And then as soon as it does something that harms us, what gets changed isn't the way we react to the dingo. We might have some rules around it, but really then you can suddenly start killing dogs, shooting dogs, restricting them. How do you think about that?
Yes, I was really glad to read that Ugo Mattei article where he said that humans have come to expect to be safe wherever we go, and because dingoes are ostensibly killed on Gari on Fraser Island to keep people safe. I mean, Bold was killed because he was deemed to be a safety risk to people. So to start rethinking it and going, no, we don't deserve, or you know, that this thing, humans don't have to be safe wherever we go. We don't have to go around and kill other living things to keep us safe. I mean, there's a lot of problems with that policy of killing dingoes to keep people safe on Gari, because it doesn't seem to they've published data that it doesn't reduce the number of serious incidents reported, so there doesn't seem to be any point to killing dingoes. But and people hurt themselves in all sorts of other ways, you know, by driving their four-wheel drives into quicksand, or you know, getting stranded, or diving into lakes, or all those things. So this lack of ability to perceive ourselves in the world, you know, with other living things, is what I hope Dingo Bold starts to do, you know, to sort of open our eyes some more to how our behaviour affects animals like dingoes.
The final point I would like to talk about, and this was just an amazing, it's toward the end of the book, about the scientific science and dingoes. this idea of dingoes being used to eradicate goats on islands around Australia, where the dingo might do that and then you can't get the dingo back off the island. They're pretty hard to catch. And this idea of having these time-activated poison capsules in the dogs. If a dog runs around, does its job, and it's like some sort of movie or something like Blade Runner, and then after a certain amount of time, the poison just starts flowing into its system.
You couldn't make this stuff up, could you? It's just so cruel. Yes, this took place in 2016, I think it was, and it had taken place before where dingoes were put on an island to eradicate the goats. But in the earlier case, in the early 90s, the dingoes then stayed on the island and they couldn't get rid of the dingoes. So this time they decided to put a poison capsule of 1080, which causes a horrific slow death very little. They didn't know how these capsules would work. They didn't know the effects, but these two dingoes were caught on the mainland and transported to an island, and then they went to work to eradicate the goats. And the organisers of that project rated it as a success too. The capsules didn't work. the dingoes lived for much longer than they were expected to, and the goats were eradicated, but a lot of them were shot as well. Like it was, because there was such a controversy about the dingoes, the organisers were ordered to take the dingoes off the island. So there was a bit of an effort to go in and try and find them, which they couldn't do. During those attempts, they did shoot a lot of goats, but I'm sure that and what is deeply troubling, I think, is that some of the organisers of this this project to eradicate the goats are also very involved with the Fraser Island Dingo Conservation and Risk Management Strategy. So they're advising Queensland Parks and Wildlife Service about how to manage the dingoes, but they have this very inhumane attitude, I guess, towards dingoes, rather than trying to see it from a dingo's point of view or what would a dingo want. It's very much dingoes as these kind of pest animals or these disposable beings.
Mm. Yeah, well, thank you for that. It's a wonderful book, Dingo Bold. It's available through Sydney University Press. I think it's available at the moment. It's been released.
Yes,
it's in the shops now. You can order it. It's a great survey of dingoes, of humans, of people, so much about this animal. Now, Rowena, before you go, could you please let the audience know what you're working on next, what your next literary plans are?
I'm still writing about dingoes. I've been working on that project in a couple of academic articles coming out about the dingoes on the island with the goats and dingoes and decolonization as well, to try and link how dingoes, relationships of dingoes with indigenous perspectives, which is hard because I'm non-indigenous, so I have a lot to learn. And I've also been I've been writing about a shipwreck, so I'm very interested in tales of life at sea at the moment. I don't know what the next long form project will be. These are shorter pieces, essays, and of course, there's always the novella on the back burner that I'll get back to it. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, thank you very much, Rowena, for coming in today.
Oh, thank you, Bea.
No, my pleasure. And thank you for listening, everyone. Please feel free to place a review wherever you pick up this podcast from. And this has been Bede Haynes on the Australian and New Zealand channel for the New Books Network, talking with Rowena Lennox about Dingo Bold. Thank you.